Water, water everywhere, and not a drop to drink. So laments the ancient mariner in Samuel Taylor Coleridge's famous tale, The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, in which an ill-fated ship's crew suffers misfortune on the high seas, which they blame on the mariner for killing their lucky albatross. The sunburnt sailors find themselves stranded. They are starving. And as the days creep by, their water supply runs dry. And quite a predicament to be in when you find yourself adrift at the high seas. All right, water in abundance, but none that can satisfy. None that can quench your thirst. In fact, the water that's available will only make things worse. It will only compound your misery. It reminds me of the predicament that many in our world face today. We don't have a mariner to blame for the internet. I mean, I guess we could blame Al Gore, but truth be told, we have all had a hand in creating the monster that it is today. We are morally stranded. We are starving for truth. With information in abundance, but none that can satisfy the soul. None that can quench man's thirst for meaning. In fact, much of what's available is poison. It will only compound our misery. But we drink it up anyway. And we drink it in abundance. Why? Why do we put ourselves at risk to something that might harm us? I think the answer is because we are thirsty. We're thirsty. It is an issue that is facing the people in our text today. There is a drought in the land of Israel, not of water, but of the Word. But the Word became flesh and dwelt among them. And in our text today, He will offer Himself to them. And the only question is, are they thirsty? Pick it up with me. We'll be in John chapter 7. As you recall, John's gospel is an ancient tract. It is an evangelistic appeal. He wants the people to have life. But since life is only found in the name Jesus, John wrote this gospel, including these signs, which would provide sufficient evidence so that people would believe that Jesus is the one that we have been waiting for. All right, the signs he includes prove that Jesus is a particular person we've been anticipating. He is the Christ. He is the King of Israel, the one that we've been looking for from Psalm 2, the one who is the Son of God, who rules the nations, who removes the curse, who restores the life that we lost in the garden. He's the fulfillment of Old Testament expectation. So if you want life, the abundant variety, the kind that just keeps on going, eternal life, then you need Jesus. And that's who John wants to introduce you to. Last week, the conflict in John's gospel that began in chapter 5 between Jesus and the religious rulers for what they perceived as a Sabbath violation. As you recall, he healed a man on the Sabbath. They said, no, you can't do that. You can't provide release to the captives on the Sabbath. You can't provide healing to someone on the Sabbath. They saw it as a violation. Well, that initial conflict spread to the people last week in chapter 6, who were seeking Jesus for the signs that he could perform. You know, they wanted bread to fill their bellies, but they were not interested in the greater Moses that the sign of the bread was supposed to point to. They were not interested in that. And as soon as Jesus tried to introduce them to himself as true bread, it was time to leave. They deserted him. They didn't want anything to do with it. And John recorded this to show that Jesus' signs and his testimony were being rejected. They're being rejected by the religious leaders. They're being rejected by the people. Pick it up with me. Chapter 7, verse 1. After these things, Jesus was walking in Galilee. For he was unwilling to walk in Judea because the Jews were seeking to kill him. Now the feast of the Jews, the feast of booths, was near. Therefore his brothers said to him, "Leave here and go into Judea, so that your disciples also may see your works which you are doing. For no one does anything in secret when he himself seeks to be known publicly. If you do these things, show yourself to the world." For not even his brothers were believing in him. So Jesus said to them, "My time is not yet here, but your time is always opportune. The world cannot hate you, but it hates me, because I testify of it that its deeds are evil. Go up to the feast yourselves. I do not go up to this feast, because my time has not yet come." And having said these things to them, he stayed in Galilee. 6 months have passed since chapter 5, and Jesus has been keeping a low profile. He's been hanging out in Galilee, not Judea, because verse 1, the people in Judea are trying to kill him. And it was not his time. He has been focusing his ministry in Galilee, but the Feast of Tabernacles is approaching, Sukkot, which is a festival that celebrated God's care for his people as they wandered in the wilderness for 40 years on their journey to the Promised Land. It was a mandatory celebration. Everybody had to go. You got to go up to Jerusalem. You have to celebrate. And Jesus' brothers say, "Well, what better time to go and to do all these wonders that we've been hearing about than at the feast? Seems like an opportune time for you, Jesus. Seems like the right time. Since you want to make a name for yourself, why not go do it?" You know, they sound like modern day Mythbusters. You hear about a self-proclaimed magician, healer. Then you want to go and you want to put them to the test. You want to see their works so that you can believe. "If you do these things, show me." Which tells me that Jesus has not been doing many wonders in his home country. Certainly not in the sight of his brothers. And that's what the text will tell us. You might recall a few chapters before in John chapter 4, verse 44, the statement is made by Jesus. He testifies that a prophet has no honor in his own country. "We know your mama. We know your daddy. We know where you're from. You're not a big shooter to us." I also think of Mark's account, though, which adds a little bit to the mix. Jesus once again makes the statement, "A prophet is not without honor," in Mark 6, verse 4 and 5. "A prophet is not without honor except in his hometown and among his own relatives and in his own household." But then it includes, "And he could do no miracle there except that he laid hands on a few sick people and healed them. And he wondered at their unbelief." Had his brothers not heard of the miracle he did at the wedding of Cana, where he turned the water to wine? Had they not heard about his healing of the official's son? Or his multiplying of the bread? Well, certainly they had. But it would appear that they had not seen it. They heard. They've seen the crowds. They've heard about what he's saying about himself. They've heard about what people are saying he's been doing, but they have not seen it. So they tell Jesus, "Why don't you come with us, since you're such a big shooter? Let's go to the temple. Here's the festival. Let's see it. Do your works. Make a name for yourself. Prove you are who you say you are." Which is what we might expect Jesus to do if that's indeed what his ministry is about. You know, we might expect him to go and do a sign and then say, "All right, now go tell it on the mountain. Go tell everybody. Tell them all what you've seen me do so that they'll know who I am and they'll recognize me and accept me." But that is not what we find him doing in the Gospels. Usually he's going around, he is healing, and then he's telling people, "Now don't go tell anybody about it. Keep it to yourself. Don't tell them that I did this." And I used to think, man, Jesus, isn't that counterintuitive to your mission? Now, why are you doing that? But I think I understand now. I think I know why he does it. And we've certainly seen the outcome of their disobeying that particular imperative in John. But we find it more clearly in the book of Mark. Just listen to this. This is Mark chapter 1, verse 40. We find that a leper came to Jesus, beseeching him and falling on his knees before him and saying, "If you're willing, you can make me clean." Moved with compassion, Jesus stretched out his hand and touched him and said to him, "I am willing. Be cleansed." Immediately the leprosy left him and he was cleansed. And he sternly warned him and immediately sent him away. And he said to him, "See that you say nothing to anyone, but go show yourself to the priest and offer for your cleansing what Moses commanded as a testimony to them." But he went out and began to proclaim it freely and to spread the news around to such an extent that Jesus could no longer publicly enter a city, but stayed out in unpopulated areas, and they were coming to him from everywhere. The religious rulers were supposed to be the stewards of the kingdom. Remember when we were going through the book of Matthew, when he starts giving the parables, he's saying, look, to you it's been granted to know the mysteries of the kingdom. To them it hadn't been granted. He tells Peter, he's going to give him the keys to the kingdom. We're taking the stewardship from them and giving it to the apostles. The apostles will have the information necessary to get into the kingdom. They won't. But right here, they are supposed to be the stewards. They're supposed to be the ushers. They're supposed to be the people pointing the way. They were supposed to be the ones who recognized Jesus as the anticipated Messiah and then told the people, y'all need to look to him. So what Jesus would do is he would go and he would heal someone, and then he would tell them to go to the priests and give the appropriate offering as a testimony to them, as a witness to them, so that the religious rulers would see this and say, oh my, something is going on. We recognize this. We know what this is pointing to. And they would find Jesus and lead the people to Jesus. But that is not what took place. Instead, Jesus would heal someone, and they would not go to the priest. They would not offer the offering. Instead, they'd go tell all their friends. This had a number of consequences. The first is that it hindered Jesus' preaching, because so many were coming to him that he cannot freely move about. He is pressed upon by so many crowds coming in that he has to ask the disciples for a boat so he can just hang out in the boat to talk to people. It hindered his preaching. The second thing it did is it hindered his message. You see, when people are going out saying, this guy has the ability to heal, it attracts the kind of people that are looking for somebody to heal. People begin coming for the signs, not for the greater Moses that the signs were pointing to. They treat him like he's a bronze serpent. You know, they want to touch him. They make an idol out of him. You know, well, if he has, this is a magic man. I want to see the good stuff. But they're not interested in the kingdom that he's offering. They want bread in their bellies right now. So it hindered his preaching. It hindered his message. They're not listening to what he's saying. They're just coming for what he can do. And then thirdly, it presented him to the religious rulers, not as the fulfillment of Moses. Now, show the appropriate sacrifice as a testimony to them. That's not how they're hearing about him. Instead, they're hearing about him as a competing teacher that is growing larger crowds than they are. And so they're becoming jealous of him instead. They're not seeing him as the one we've been looking for. They're seeing him as competition. Someone who's going to lead the people astray, because surely they have the truth. And if the people aren't coming to them, if they're coming to Jesus instead, well, they're not following the truth. False teacher. And so they become jealous and become opponents. So I see that. I look at what's going on here. Jesus wasn't trying to make a name for himself. This is what his brothers think. Oh, you just want to draw the crowds. You want to be a big shooter. It's not what he's trying to do. He wants to present himself to Israel to be accepted as the king. He wants them to recognize that, no, he isn't perfectly in line with the law, with Moses, and he wants the religious rulers then to do their job and cause the people to return to God by returning through David, their king, who he is. So he's trying to do that, and he certainly couldn't do it if he's captured and killed in secret, first of all. Okay, the people in Judea are trying to take him out of the game, but they don't want to do it in a public place. You know, they want to do it, they want to cut him off at the beginning before things kick off. So he's been making himself scarce. He says, you guys can go at any time. You guys can do this stuff at any time. Your time's always opportune. The world loves you. You're of the world. It doesn't have that same relationship with me. All right, my time is not always opportune. I can't go whenever I want. So they leave without him. But that doesn't mean that he's not going to go to the feast. He has to go up to the feast. It's mandatory. Funny thing about this particular feast, Feast of Booths. The Feast of Booths is something that you will celebrate in the future. The nations, by the way, in the future that go into the kingdom, Zechariah chapter 14 talks about it, will be glorified, will be with the Lord at that time. But the nations that live in the millennial kingdom in Zechariah 14 will be required to do this, to make a journey, to go see the king and pay homage for the Feast of Booths. And if they don't, they don't get rain. This is a forever feast. It is a forever festival, Zechariah 14. But right now, here they go. They go up. Jesus lets them go. He waits, and then he goes. Verse 10, notice it. When his brothers had gone up to the feast, then he himself also went up. Not publicly, but as if in secret. So the Jews were seeking him at the feast. They're saying, where is he? And there was much grumbling among the crowds concerning him. Some were saying he's a good man. Others were saying, no, no. On the contrary, he leads the people astray. Yet no one was speaking openly of him for fear of the Jews. See, Jesus doesn't go up with his brothers, but he does go. And when he gets there, he finds out that the children of that first generation that they've come together to celebrate, you know, they're celebrating their wanderings of that first generation. Well, these folks are doing the same thing that first generation did. They are grumbling. It runs in the family. But their grumblings aren't about the lack of food and the lack of water. They're grumbling about Jesus. Everybody has an opinion about Jesus. Everybody has something to say about Jesus. Some say he's a good guy. He's got some good things to say. Others say, I don't know what y'all are talking about. This guy is a false prophet. He's getting us in trouble. He's leading people away from God. He's going to get us in trouble with Rome. And I got to be honest, the false prophet guys make a lot more sense to me. You know, so he's done miraculous signs, to be sure, in their midst. He came to Jerusalem doing these things. But remember, the test of a prophet, whether a prophet is true or not, is not whether or not they can do crazy signs. That does not validate or invalidate a prophet. Remember, Deuteronomy 13 gives us the standard of a prophet. Listen to this. Deuteronomy 13, verse 1. If a prophet or a dreamer of dreams arises among y'all and gives y'all a sign or a wonder, and the sign or wonder comes true, concerning which he spoke to you, saying, let us go after other gods, whom you have not known, and let us serve them. You shall not listen to the words of that prophet or that dreamer of dreams. For the Lord your God is testing you to find out if you love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul. And say, you follow the Lord, you fear him. But that prophet or that dreamer of dreams shall be put to death because he has counseled rebellion against the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt and redeemed you from the house of slavery. So you put him down. I don't care what he can do. I don't care if he can call down fire from heaven. If he says go after another god, you don't listen to him. And that's an important thing, because there will come somebody in the future who can do just that. An Elijah-like miracle so as to mislead even the elect. Because remember, Elijah has to come before Messiah. He's saying, I don't care if he can do what Elijah did. If he doesn't talk like Elijah talked, false prophet. So here we have Jesus. Yes, he does incredible signs, but he's also making incredible claims. And some are saying, I don't know about this one. I don't know about this one. But others are saying, oh yeah, he's a good man. He's a good man. Well, I don't know how you can listen to any of the things that Jesus says and come away with such a milquetoast, lukewarm opinion that he is just a good guy. I don't think that we'd be comfortable with someone who said the kind of stuff that Jesus said. We would not call them a good guy. We'd say they are a megalomaniac or perhaps much worse. But ask people today, they'll give you the same kind of responses. He's a good man. He was a good teacher. You know, they'll put him on the level of Buddha or somebody else, Gandhi. He was a good man. He was a good teacher, but he wasn't God. It was C.S. Lewis who famously responded to this particular line of reasoning in his book Mere Christianity, where he wrote, I am trying here to prevent anyone saying the really foolish thing that people often say about Jesus. I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God. That is the one thing we must not say. A man who is merely a man and said the sort of things that Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic on the level with the man who says that he's a poached egg, or else he would be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman, or something worse. You can shut him up for a fool, you can spit at him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come with any patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us. He did not intend to. Jesus is presenting himself as the Son of God. In no uncertain terms. And the people are going to have to make a choice. He's not going to let them get away with their grumbling. He's not going to let them get away with their divisions on whether, well, he's a good man, he's a false prophet. Notice it. Verse 14. When it was now in the midst of the feast, Jesus went up into the temple and began to teach. And the Jews then were astonished, saying, how has this man become learned, having never been educated? And so Jesus answered them, and he said, my teaching is not mine, but his who sent me. If anyone is willing to do his will, he'll know the teaching, whether it's of God or whether I speak for myself. He who speaks from himself seeks his own glory, but he who's seeking the glory of the one who sent him, he is true, and there is no unrighteousness in him. Did not Moses give y'all the law? And yet, none of y'all carries out the law. Why do you seek to kill me? And the crowd answered, you have a demon. Who seeks to kill you? Jesus answered them, I did one work, and you all marvel. For this reason, Moses has given you circumcision, not because it's from Moses, but from the fathers. And on the Sabbath, y'all circumcise a man. If a man receives circumcision on the Sabbath, so that the law of Moses won't be broken, are y'all angry with me because I made an entire man well on the Sabbath? Don't judge according to appearance, but judge with righteous judgment. Does this sound like a good moral teacher to you? He is claiming to be sent from God. He's saying, I'm God's gift to y'all. If you listen to God, well, you'd listen to me. Now, the funny thing is, you know, the crowds, they try to gaslight Jesus. He comes in and says, see, y'all aren't from God. Y'all are actually trying to kill me. That's what y'all want to do. They said, who's trying to kill you? You're crazy. You've got a demon. We don't know what you're talking about. What is this guy talking about saying somebody's trying to kill him? You know, you got to have a screw loose. You got to have a demon getting into your head. Got to be a conspiracy theorist, Jesus.
Nobody's trying to kill you.
It's a funny thing to say because in the very next line we read that some of the people of Jerusalem were saying, is this the man that they're trying to seek to kill? They said, nobody's trying to kill you. Is this the guy they're looking for? Yeah, they're trying to kill him. But Jesus' argument is like, look, you circumcise a man on the Sabbath, do you not? Remember, the religious rulers were after him because he healed a man on the Sabbath. He healed a whole man. Saying, you guys happily do your works on the Sabbath. The Father can't do his works through his Son on the Sabbath. You can't show mercy on the Sabbath. But they're trying to kill him. They're gaslighting him. They're saying, nobody's trying to kill you, Jesus. You're paranoid. While they're saying, hey, why aren't the religious leaders yanking him up? Because here he is. If they're looking for him, here he is. So they say, verse 26, look, he's speaking publicly. And these religious rulers, they're saying nothing to him. The rulers don't really know that this is the Christ, do they? However, look, we know that this man, we know where this man is from. But whenever the Christ may come, nobody knows where he's from. When Jesus cried out in the temple, teaching and saying, you both know me and know where I'm from. I haven't come from myself, but he who sent me is true, whom you don't know. I know him because I am from him and he sent me. So they were seeking to seize him, and no man laid his hand on him because his hour had not yet come. But many of the crowd believed him, because they were saying, when the Christ comes, he will not perform more signs than those which this man has, will he? See, they gaslight him. Nobody's trying to kill you, but the people that are trying to kill you aren't doing anything about it. I mean, he's teaching in the temple, for goodness sake. He's proclaiming to be sent of God. He's proclaiming to be the one they've been looking for with neon lights behind him. Nobody's doing anything about it. Why not? He's in the temple on the feast, for goodness sake. Well, it seems to me that the problem is this is exactly the situation that the religious rulers were trying to avoid. Here he is. In a public setting, he's speaking. He's talking to the crowds, and some of the crowds are believing him. Which means if you go take him out, I mean, you really need to censor him. You really need to stop him from talking. Because if you don't stop him soon, you're going to have a lot of people following after him. And then if you take him, you're going to have a riot on your hands. You got to shut him down. Which is what they tried to do. Verse 32. The Pharisees heard the crowd muttering these things. And the chief priests and the Pharisees sent officers to seize him. And Jesus says, for a little while longer I'm with y'all, but then I'm going to go to him who sent me. You'll seek me, you won't find me, and where I am you cannot come. And the Jews said to one another, where does this man think he's going to go, that we can't find him? He's not intending to go to the dispersion among the Greeks and teach the Greeks, is he? What is this statement? He said, you'll seek me, but you won't find me, and where I am, you cannot come. Now, as you recall, that was Jesus' issue, right? He hasn't been going to Judea. Why? Because they're trying to kill him. They're seeking him. They can't find him. And they're thinking, what's he saying? He's going to take off again? That's not what he's talking about. You're going to get me. His hour will come. He'll go back to the Father. He'll do his ministry from the Father's right hand. They're going to get a sign. They've been seeking for a sign. But the sign is going to be the one that says, it's too late. When you've already rejected your king, when you've already killed him, when you've already condemned him, numbered him with the transgressors, when you've already pierced him through, then the Lord will give you your sign. It'll be the sign of resurrection. The sign that you have gone too far. But as it stands now, instead Jesus is going to give them an offer. Notice it, verse 37. He leaves, the officials go, they're going to try to get the officials to censor him. He's in the middle of the feast, fine, he leaves. But now, verse 37, on the last day, the great day of the feast, Jesus stood and cried out saying, if anyone is thirsty, let him come to me and drink. He who believes in me, as the scripture said, from his innermost beings will flow rivers of living water. But this he spoke of the Spirit,
whom those who believed in him were to receive, for the Spirit was not yet given because Jesus was not yet glorified.
In the words of one, the last and greatest day of the festival was a day set aside by the ancient Hebrews to plead with God for the provision of water. In the arid climate of the Middle East, the people were profoundly conscious of their need for rain from heaven for their survival. And on that day, the priest would lead a joyous procession from the temple down to the pool of Siloam. It's a pool at the end of Hezekiah's tunnel. It was actually filled by Hezekiah's tunnel. And there he would fill a golden pitcher with the water that had flowed through the ancient tunnel. He would shout the words of Isaiah 12:3, "With joy you will draw water from the wells of salvation." And he would then lead a great procession back to the temple, where he would pour the water out on the altar as a sign of faith, believing that God would supply Israel's great need. It was a symbolic gesture that declared to God, "We are trusting you that there's more to come. There's more to come." He goes on to say, in one ancient Hebrew prayer associated with this last day of the festival, the congregation leader would cry out, "Our God and the God of our forefathers, remember the patriarch Abraham, who was drawn behind you like water. You blessed him like a tree planted alongside streams of water. You shielded him. You rescued him from the fire and from water. You tested him when he sowed upon all waters." And the congregation would reply, "For his sake, do not hold water back." And then the leader would cry out again, "Remember the one Isaac, born with the tidings of 'Let some water be brought.' You told his father to slaughter him, to spill his blood like water. He too was scrupulous to pour his heart out like water. He dug and discovered wells of water." And the response would come from the congregation, "For the sake of his righteousness, grant abundant water." Now the prayer would continue in this form for several more stanzas, each rehearsing Israel's history down through the ages, showing how prominently water played into the story, both literally and figuratively. And after each stanza, the people would reply with a request that God grant abundant water. Water and not hold water back. Somewhere in the midst of all the pomp and circumstance of that day, Jesus stood up and cried out with a loud voice, "Let anyone who is thirsty come to me and drink." How is Israel's thirst met in the wilderness? Moses gave them water from the rock. And remember what Paul says about that. 1 Corinthians chapter 10. He's thinking about that first generation. He's thinking about their time in the wilderness. And he writes, "I don't want y'all, the Corinthians, to be unaware that our fathers were all under the cloud, all passed through the sea, all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea, all ate the same spiritual food, all drank the same spiritual drink. For they were drinking from a spiritual rock which followed them, and the rock was Christ." They got the water from the rock, and the rock was Christ. Paul says that. But he did not come up with that on his own. Jesus said it first. And he said it in the temple, at the height of the Jewish festival celebrating just such an occasion. He says, "Here I am. It was me. It's always been me." How do you think they took it? We may not understand the significance of what he was saying. We don't celebrate the Feast of Booths every year. This isn't ingrained into our culture. It isn't ingrained into our tradition, our memory. It is in their memory. It was in their culture. When he said in the temple, at the height of the Jewish festival, that He is the one they need to come to if they are thirsty. He can supply their water.
Do you think they understood what he was saying?
Or do you think the statement would just pass by unnoticed?
Notice at verse 40. Some of the people, therefore, when they heard these words, were saying, "This certainly is the prophet." Others were saying, "This is the Christ." Still, others were saying, "Surely the Christ is not going to come from Galilee, is he? Has not the scripture said that the Christ comes from the descendants of David and from Bethlehem, the village where David was?" And so a division occurs in the crowd because of him. And some of them wanted to seize him, but no one laid hands on him. And the officers then came to the chief priests and the Pharisees, and they said to them, "Why did you not bring him?" And the officers answered, "Never has a man spoken the way this man speaks." And the Pharisees then answered them, "You haven't also been led astray, have you? No one of the rulers of the Pharisees have believed in him, has he? But this crowd, which does not know the law, is accursed." Nicodemus, he who came to him before, being one of them, said to them, "Our law does not judge a man unless it first hears from him and knows what he's doing, does it?" They answered him, "You're not also from Galilee, are you? Search and see that no prophet arises out of Galilee." Did they understand what Jesus was claiming? Oh, they got it. They understood exactly what he was offering to them and who he was claiming to be. You say, well, some say he's the prophet, some say he's the Christ. Well, the prophet and the Christ happen to be the same person. So they recognize, oh, he is the greater Moses. He can supply their need in this new Exodus. And others are saying, well, isn't he this ruler that's going to rule over us and remove Rome? Yes and yes. Same guy. So they're putting it together. But really, the response was a mixed bag, was it not? The religious rulers are on offense. The officers are on defense. The crowds are just on the fence. Okay, is he this guy? Is he? But what about this Galilee thing? And Nicodemus, it's funny because we know the story. This is narrative. We've already read chapter 3. Nicodemus is one of the religious rulers. He's part of the crowd. They're saying, none of us elite, none of us that know what we're talking about believe this. And shouldn't that be a sign to you that Jesus is wrong? Because if he was right, then all of us who really know, some of us would believe. But you as the reader know, some of you do believe. Some of you are sneaking up to Jesus by cover of night because this is not a popular opinion. But he knows that he's of God. Because no one could do the works that he's doing unless God sent him. So we know that. They don't know that. And what he advises, he says, look, if you guys want to lawyer up on this guy, well, you better follow the law. You got to do it by the law. You know, we can't just go and throw the book at him without having a justifiable reason to. We got to do it by the law. But the problem is these guys show that they don't know the law. And they do it in the way that we do it too. When you don't know something, you know, you posture on it. Say, well, you go read for yourself and see that this isn't the case. You'll see. But I already know that y'all know that that's not the case. They say, go back and read it for yourself. No prophet comes from Galilee, but I hear David laughing over here because he's been teaching y'all Isaiah. And what does Isaiah have to say? That's Isaiah chapter 9. Now, it's funny. In the story, there actually are prophets that come from Galilee. Jonah is from the region that Galilee is in. Nahum is from the region that Galilee is in. But if we're looking at anticipating a prophet, certainly the text that John wants us to have in mind is this. Isaiah 9, verse 1. There will be no more gloom for her who was in anguish. In earlier times he treated the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali with contempt. But later he shall make it glorious by the way of the sea on the other side of the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles. The people who walk in darkness will see a great light. Those who live in a dark land, the light will shine on them. You shall multiply the nation. You shall increase their gladness. They will be glad in your presence as with the gladness of harvest. He'll go on to say, verse 6, for a child will be born to us, a son will be given to us, and the government will rest on his shoulders. His name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Father of Eternity, Prince of Peace, and there will be no end to the increase of his government or of peace on the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and uphold it with justice and righteousness from then on and forevermore. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will accomplish this. And interestingly, that same chapter will go on to detail the second exodus that this one will lead. Is he the prophet? Is he the Christ? Well, the chapter that John's going to point you to is going to say, yep. See, not only will he rule on his father's throne, on David's throne, he's going to lead them out of Egypt a second time. He's going to lead them out of Gentile dominion. He's both. And of course, they say, we know where you're from. Well, that's because a child is born, but a son will be given. Yeah, you know my mom. But I came from God. See, I was conceived by the Holy Spirit and born of the Virgin Mary. Search the scriptures and see that no prophet comes from Galilee. Challenge accepted. And that's exactly what we find. But that's who he says he is. Now, when I look at a text such as this, I look at this situation, I look at the presentation, I look at the claims, and I look at the response of the nation, I can't help but also ask the question about us. What about us? What do we take from a text such as this? Well, the number one thing John is wanting his readers to ask when they come to this text is, are you thirsty? Are you thirsty? This is Jesus. This is the Christ. He is the prophet. He is the one who has offered living water. Remember, at this point in the story, he's talking about the Spirit, but the Spirit hasn't come yet because Jesus hasn't been glorified yet. But guess what? When John had written this, Jesus had both been crucified, buried, and risen, and was glorified. The Spirit has been sent. It is all available. You can have it now. The only question is, are you thirsty? You say, well, I have come to the water. I have drunk from the well. I have received the Spirit. I have gotten the life. Well, then now what? You know, last week we went to the nursing home, and Jan, while we were there, was playing trivia with the residents that were there. What she was doing, she's gone through all of these old slogans, the slogans that you'd see on TV and hear on the radio. She'd call one out and see if they knew where the slogan was from. What was the brand that she was talking about? She brought one of Coca-Cola's slogans up, which wasn't very memorable. And the reason it wasn't very memorable is because apparently Coca-Cola changes their slogan just about every year. They've got like 66 different slogans out there. So I don't blame them. I didn't know which one it was. Some of them actually did. They were pretty sharp. Their first slogan, by the way, Coca-Cola's in 1886, was drink Coke and enjoy it. Sounds like a threat. A bit ominous, right? Drink Coke and enjoy it. No wonder we need to change these slogans. That sounds like not 1886. That's like a 1984 kind of slogan. Enjoy it. But the slogan I think about when I think of soft drinks, at least, is Sprite's slogan. Y'all remember Sprite's slogan? Obey your thirst. I like that. They made a mistake. They changed it in 2006. In America, they cut it down to just obey. Here we go again. And then if you're outside of America, it became freedom from thirst. Well, I don't like either of those. See, we need our thirst. The thirst is important. It leads us to seek out the thing that can satisfy us. And obedience, what good is obedience? You know, you don't just want to obey anybody or anything. You want to obey the right one with the right thing. I obey my thirst. So my thirst has been satisfied by Jesus. So I have experienced the life. So I have received the Spirit. Now what? Lean into it. As the deer panteth for the water, so our souls ought to continue to long after our Lord and his Christ. If we have drunk deeply of Jesus, we continue drinking. We can drink and we can be satisfied.